Welcome aboard Beyond Sirius C. You are listening to Harping on You, performed by Ghost Writers in the Sky. This story softly strumming your summer way, plucked from so long ago, probably ancient history for sure, about two emerald-eyed siblings left abandoned in the old country of Ireland. Noel and Shelley their names, and they embarked on a quest for reasons pertaining to extreme elements, a magical harp, bloody wars, hunger of epic proportions, and a mystical doorway only accessible during solstice. Most parents recommend daily studies, chores galore, and healthy ways to explore. In bygone times, people weren't that much different. They worked laboriously from sunup to sundown, mostly tending to the land their day jobs, but at night, by candlelight, stories, myths, and folklore sprung to life, said with great gusto. Entrusted to the family from no one knew where, passing generations to generations, were oral traditions, accounts, and an otherworldly safeguarded musical instrument called a harp. Not just a harp, and not just anybody could play this instrument. In fact, no one was ever to see it, hear it, or know it even existed. But when you're little and curious, things can happen. Noel remembered what their mother had strictly stated about the harp, and both children were only allowed in its presence with the parents' permission granting so. For whatever reason, usually drastic and dramatic, Noel avoided the harp in general. I guess more a lute or perhaps a drum guy. Honestly, he had to work and protect the family when their father wasn't there, and he was all of maybe 15 years old. A ton of weight upon his young shoulders to carry and plenty more burdens where that came from. From the time Shelley was a wee one, she'd pluck the harp strings and sing happy, joyful, and glorious music. The sun would shine, the flowers would bloom, and all of nature would harmoniously sway in tune. She never was scared of its power because she never knew differently. The harp became her everything, essentially a best friend. Obviously, the family's pride, possession, and priceless heirloom from the awesome beyond. It was beautiful in every way, a magnificent instrument to gaze upon, mighty in proportions, 36 to 38 strings, made of the oak of two blossoms, very symbolic, intricately carved with Celtic symbols, and ornamented with bedazzling gold and the rarest jewels. Sometimes it could illuminate, and other days change the weather with the note, and even levitated a time or two, depending upon the key. Legend said it was capable of majorly altering moods, and just maybe the moon, but that's just guessing. One could say extraordinarily remarkable. Who knows if it was made on Earth, this planet? Most notably, the sound that emanated was heavenly and exquisitely pure. The mysterious origins unknown, but rumored to have come from the Tuatha De Danann. Say that 10 times. The Tuatha De Danann is Irish, meaning the folk of the goddess Danu, also known by the earlier name Tuatha De, tribe of the gods. They are a supernatural race in Irish mythology. Many of them are thought to represent deities of pre-Christian Gaelic Ireland. Medieval texts about the Tuatha De sometimes explain the Tuatha De as fallen angels, neutral angels who sided neither with God nor Lucifer and were punished by being forced to dwell on the earth, or exceptional humans who had become highly skilled in magic. Where have I heard this familiar ditty before? The Tuatha De Danann are often depicted as kings, queens, druids, bards, warriors, heroes, healers, and craftsmen who have supernatural powers. They dwell in the other world, but interact with humans and the human world. They are associated with the Sidhe, prominent ancient burial mounds such as Brunabani, which are entrances to otherworld realms. The other world spoken of is described as either a parallel world or a heavenly land beyond the sea or under the earth's surface. I've even heard green pigment children, but that's another day and across the world. Many of them are associated with specific places in the landscape, especially the Sidhe mounds, the ancient burial mounds and passage tombs, which are the entrances to other world realms. The Tuatha De can hide themselves with a Feth Feda, its magic mist, and appear to humans only when they wish to. And it's always misty and alluring, invoking a spellbound soul here, there, and the cloaked afterlife everywhere. As the ancient folklore goes, by word of mouth, maybe a Blarney stone included, or from a half-destroyed scroll in the back of a tiny leather-bound toe-up mysterious book, Wikipedia, or all of the above, The Tuatha De Danann were descended from Nemit, leader of a previous wave of inhabitants of Ireland. They came from four cities to the north of Ireland, Phaleas, Gorias, Mirius, and Phineas, where they taught their skills in the sciences, including architecture, the arts, and magic, including necromancy, considered sorcery and a smidge of black magic to commune with the dead, prophesize, and other things. According to Labor Gabala Aran, they came to Ireland in dark clouds and landed on the mountains of the Comanche Rain in Conchata. I know I butchered that. Otherwise, Sibyl and Aran, and they brought a darkness over the sun for 3 days and three nights. They immediately burnt the ships so that they should not think of retreating to them, and the smoke and the mist that came from the vessels filled the neighboring land and air. Therefore, it was conceived that they had arrived in clouds of mist. A poem in the Labor Gabala Aran says of their arrival, "It is God who suffered them, though he restrained them. They landed with horror, with lofty deed, in their cloud of mighty combat of specters upon a mountain of Kinmichi of Connacht." Again, I'm sorry I butchered that. Without distinction to discerning Ireland, without ships or ruthless course, the truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth. To stepping it back to harps, and just to harp on you, the earliest Irish references to stringed instruments are from the 6th century, and players of such instruments were held in high regard by the nobility of the time. Early Irish law from 700 AD stipulates that bards and cruet, old-timey term for harp, players should sit with the nobility at banquets and not with the common entertainers. The harp is a stringed musical instrument that has individual strings running at an angle to its soundboard. The strings are plucked with the fingers. Harps can be made and played in various ways, standing or sitting, and in orchestras or concerts. The harp has been used as a political symbol of Ireland for centuries. According to tradition, Brian Boru, High King of Ireland, died at the Battle of Clontarf, 1014, played the harp, as did many of the gentry in the country during the period of the Gaelic lordship of Ireland, ended circa 1607 with the flight of the earls following the Elizabethan Wars. We'll stick with the fly in the ether this sunny and vibrant day of summer solstice, and we'll chat flights, concords, instruments, angels, bands, and royalty another time, writing about all things musical, comical, truthful, and plentiful. Maybe some macaroons and Irish milk chocolate would be beneficial. A spot of whiskey might not be out of the question. I digress. Back to the story in mention. Historical sources mention various types of wire, including brass and iron, and some scholars also argue for the use of silver and gold. The wires were attached to a massive sound box, typically carved from a single log, commonly of willow, although other words, including alder and poplar, have been identified in extant harps. Shout out Wikipedia and harp enthusiasts, harpists, harpers, and all stringed players. The playing of the wire-strung harp has been described as extremely difficult. Because of the long-lasting resonance, the performer had to dampen strings which had just been played while new strings were being plucked, and this while playing rapidly. Contrary to conventional modern practice, the left hand played the treble and the right the bass. It was said that a player should begin to learn the harp no later than the age of 7. Shelley had been plucking that harp her whole life, originally needing a step stool to reach the top strings. It was concealed most of the time underneath a massive wool blanket, completely camouflaged in the old homestead. No one would be the wiser. Not that there were any visitors, if ever. For all Shelley knew, they were the only family in Ireland, and had the mountains, the green hills, the ocean, and all the sky as hers alone. The common Irish word for a house is teic, lactectum. A dwelling in general is denoted by arus, a homestead by bailey, now generally anglicized bailey, but used in a more extended sense to denote a townland. The word bro or brook bro was also applied to a large dwelling. Props to LibraryIreland.com. Farmhouses, country houses, bros, and thatched grandparents' cottages. Oh, and least I forget, full formal bows to flighty fairies, scary harpies, and tasty pastries. One day came quietly and somberly, the realization that both parents were not coming back. All sorts of fears and dread come to mind out in the vastness of the land. What do we do? Where do we go? How are we going to survive? Plague? No. And he contemplated day and night, praying to God his parents would return, or by some small sliver or shrivel of hope, still alive. The worst case scenario entered their minds, that something wicked had befallen. They'd never leave their children willingly. The siblings kept themselves very busy and tried to emulate their guardian's actions to the T. Shelley hadn't really followed the rules entirely, since there weren't any ramifications, but the consequences were yet to come. Noel was tending to the scarcely there barren crops, while Shelley hummed along to the harp. Off in the distance, several hundred yards, a soldier came up over the hill, and easily visible. The soldier was holding what appeared to be a sword, a sun-glistened blade, and waved behind him like to a fleet of more soldiers. There were what seemed like 100 men, mad dashing in the children's direction, and absolutely nowhere to hide. The unthinkable was happening. Not like they had horses or horsepower to ride off into the sunset. No boat to float, zero weapons besides a good rock-throwing arm like Noel had. Nope, they were goners. His baby sister wouldn't live to see another day, and he would, if lucky, be recruited, but likely slaughtered. Dark clouds formed and the whipping wind started howling, and strong gusts were swirling through the air. Noel thought even if they tried to hide, it would be to no avail. There really was only one thing he could do that he wasn't supposed to do. Noel's father had told him of gruesome tales, awful wars, and losing umpteen family members to the gore, disease, ailments, bloodbaths, and the horror of it all, teaching Noel to be a good man and work the land for the love of all life and kin. His father also said, if ever no choice, pluck the harp in an upwards motion towards your heart. In those split seconds, that's all he could think. Told you lots of wars to be wary of, but I digress. Back to the musical gem of a tale. Shelley was frozen with fear, and Noel started running towards her. Noel knew they were coming for Euthyne. As fast as he could run, yelling for Shelley to hide in the house, Noel could feel the ground beneath him as if it was rumbling. Never felt a stampede of this magnitude before, and behind him, he heard succinctly a battle cry. Yep, you heard battle cry correctly, and probably the most frightening experience one could imagine or fathom. I mean, you just know nothing good is behind that motion, and the energy is palpable aggression. So obviously not what two teenagers envisioned as possible odds in their favor of ever there being a good outcome. Slamming through the doorway frantic, and Shelley, petrified with fear, couldn't move. Noel threw back the wool blanket, exposing Euthyne for all her glory. He said, they're here for Euthyne, they can't take her. Shelley had no idea that the harp had a name, much less that a violent mob of soldiers were willing to kill them for it. Cover your ears, Shelley. Adrenaline now coursing through Noel's veins, and Shelley was hiding under the wool blanket, cowering from fear, covered her ears and closed tight her eyes. Noel strummed instead of a pluck, and what happened was a sonic boom of sorts that almost leveled the house, knocking out, incapacitating Noel exactly at the foot of the harp. It was quiet for a minute, and Shelley couldn't hear Noel, the soldiers, nor the storm. Was it over? She peeked out from the blanket and saw Noel lying on the floor, rushed to his side and tried to revive her brother. Thought for a moment he was dead. A massive relief when she could see his chest breathing, but couldn't understand the gravity of the situation. Outside, the scene became more horrific. Men strewn and passed out everywhere, maybe feet from reaching the children themselves. What if they wake up? Was a terrifying thought. Shelley decided it had to be the harp that saved her. And since Euthyne had that ability, maybe a lighter touch would wake her brother back up. Hours went by, and Noel never moved, neither did the soldiers. Shelley knew she had to be smart and took the time to devise a planned escape. Barely a pluck and Noel started to stir, but fear made her stop, for she didn't want the men outside to become aware of her presence. Too late. Noel awoke panic-stricken and ready to fight for their lives. He went for the harp again and strummed Euthyne. This time, however, he started laughing uncontrollably. Shelley thought he'd gone mad. Looking outside, the soldiers were also dying of laughter, holding their sides with crying laughter. It didn't have the same effect on Shelley, but oddly, she too found it weirdly funny. Some men kept trying to stand, then falling down laughing, and others were crawling away, retreating from their mission. Cramping from laughter, then morphed into crying out loudly. This wasn't funny anymore, and Noel cried for Shelley to play Euthyphro the way she does. There wasn't more time, and sadly, Shelley started to fear the harp she'd come to love so much. Her brother, writhing in excruciating pain, was all she could bear to witness, and left his side to attend this curse. Instead of a normally cheerful and happy tune, Shelley opted for a formal song, kinda green sleeves jingle or little number, however you hear it. It was like a farewell to thee, harmony, knowing Euthyphro must return to her rightful place, even if that was another realm, dimension, or entirely different plane of existence, the underworld. As she played the otherworldly magical harp, Shelley mourned what would be letting go of a dear friend, the abandonment of her parents, the hunger and strife her brother endured, and the absolute fear of death and what was to come, the unknown. Looking up, Shelley breathed out a finale. No idea how long she was lost playing, humming, reminiscing, and singing, and locked eyes with her brother. Noel was smiling. The sun was shining and not one soldier or human in sight. Some birds flew by. The trees and the flowers never looked more in bloom. Noel said, maybe once we return, Euthyphro, we'll see our parents. They were off to Newgrange. Today is solstice, and some have said the only day a portal opens up and an entrance appears. Of course, I haven't talked to too many people who have come and gone to tell the tale. There are a couple, though, and Noel and Shelley are two of them. This is to be continued. P.S. The road or portal is long, winding, and at times treacherous. But the dynamic duo run into Euridice on the trail, a magical well, a woman named Shannon who embodies a river from drowning, one-eyed monsters, hazelnut trees, a stone that is found by a woman named Bethune. Heads up for all the Bethanies out there. Then this world's end is near, and salmon fishing for sacred knowledge. Sounds yum. Hope you join me and thank you for visiting. Happy longest day of the year. May the best day of your past be the worst day of your future.